present legally sufficient cases, cases that are constitutional, and their fear of being subject to disciplinary action. I'll be more than happy to answer any questions.
Thank you. Are there questions for Mr. Markey or Mr. Sutherland?
Mr. Chair.
Representative Shetterly.
I guess just for my own information, does this raise a separation of powers issue where you've got the Supreme Court vested with the authority to regulate the conduct of the bar and ethical rules of disciplinary procedure and those kinds of things? What's the analysis there?
I believe that the Attorney General's office and Eric Wasserman can address that, but my understanding is that, in fact, it does raise a separation of powers issue if this were an attempt to amend the DRs, the disciplinary rules. The statute provides that amendments to the disciplinary rules have to go through the bar, to the Board of Governors, to the House of Delegates, and then approval or non-approval by the Supreme Court, and that process is going on. But the Gatti decision was based not only on the disciplinary rule, 1-201, but also on the statute that this would amend. It seems to us that in order to fix the Gatti issue, that you need to have both the legislative fix to change the statute that the Supreme Court interpreted and a disciplinary rule. There is now ongoing, and the bar, I think, can address this, attempts to revise the disciplinary rule to fix this, but that the but there is a separation of powers issue. This only goes to one portion of the Gatti decision.
Mr. Chairman, I guess the short answer on this is no. There's not a separation of powers issue as to this bill. There would be if there was an attempt to amend the disciplinary rules. We've tried, as Mr. Sutherland says, the House of Delegates of the State Bar voted 110-60, I believe, to recommend a change that was broader than this. That was rejected by the Supreme Court.
Mr. Chair?
Representative Shetterly.
Well, I, again, just seeing these as I get in the room this morning, how can we amend, how can we authorize conduct by statute that the disciplinary rules prohibit or that would be in violation of the disciplinary rules? I mean, I guess we can amend the statute to authorize this conduct, but aren't we then effectively putting lawyers who rely on that statute for the way they go about their business at risk of still violating the underlying disciplinary rule that we can't amend?
I think you have to view it as sort of going through two gates. This raises one gate. It does not allow us to drive through the other gate. Both gates have to be open in order for us to be able to do our job. This is a partial fix.
Representative Sherrilyn.
So will there be a warning in the statute to anybody who looks at this? This warning, do not rely on this?
I can assure you, Representative Shetterly, that I think every prosecutor in Oregon is aware that their license to practice law and their livelihood is at risk unless the disciplinary rule is changed. But if the disciplinary rule changed by itself without the statutory fix, we'd be in the same boat, basically.
Further questions to the either of these gentlemen? I guess I have a question. We have a -2 amendment and a -3 amendment in front of us. Have both of you gentlemen had an opportunity to review both amendments?
Yes.
Yes, I have, Mr. Chairman.
I guess I'd like both of you to just give me your comments on the differences between the -2 and the -3. And I believe I heard Mr. Markey state a preference for the -3s. Am I right about that?
Yes, in terms of these are all coming down relatively quickly, as I'm sure you can tell.
For us, too.
And after some consultation between some of the drafters, the federal agencies, which have a slightly different interest than the state agencies, I think the prosecutors and government attorneys concurred that the -3 amendments are preferable.
Mr. Sutherland, is that...
That's correct. We prefer the -3. Some of the changes, at least from the first draft to the -3, were some of the suggestions that my office made. One is that instead of saying federal agencies, we just said federal government to simplify it. I think we substituted the word covert for undercover. I don't have a vested interest one way or the other about covert or undercover. And use the word deceit and misrepresentation because that's parallels the language in the DR. But our preference is for the third version, -3.
Okay, and I guess I'd like, Mr. Prince, maybe you can help us out, counsel. You had indicated just briefly to me that in the dash threes, the first sentence under section two, the notwithstanding any other provision of ORS 9.005 to 9.755, makes this a complete, it just simply makes it stand on its own without regard to those sections, whereas in the dash twos it would have made it a part of those sections.
Mr. Chairman, I asked LC to draft, first of all, if you look at the dash twos, they specifically only amend the statute, part of Chapter 9 that Mr. Gatti was found to be in violation of, ORS 9.527. I had LC draft the dash 1 and dash 3 amendments broadly so that it is a conference of statutory power that does not, you know, it's not specific to the single statute that was violated.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Shetterly.
Well, it's interesting that this is being, I guess, posited as remedying the Gatti decision. But, of course, the Gatti decision addressed an attorney in a civil case, a civil context. I understand that the application has been broader than that, obviously, than to law enforcement. But I guess it seems to me if what we're doing is raising the bar or raising one gate, understanding that there's still another gate that has to be raised, if we're going to do that, why limit the amendment to just law enforcement and government attorneys, as Gatti got himself in trouble by, I think it was in a civil case, using or misrepresenting himself to get some information out of an insurance company, as I recall. I mean, I know that there's a technique, that's how Erin Brockovich made herself famous, working in civil litigation. Why are we addressing this fix only to prosecution and not to defense, for instance, or to civil cases that may legitimately make the same arguments as to how they need to operate in kind of cloak and dagger fashion to get at information that's just not going to be readily presented to them through discovery?
Mr. Sutherland? May I respond to that?
Yes, you may.
This has been a discussion that's been going on since the bar organized the study group to revise the Gatti decision. We had representatives on that study group, Mr. Williamson from the bar, some members of the criminal defense bar, Steve Wax from Public Defender's Office, members of people who do fair house testing, who use testers, which is an issue in this. And one of the initial discussions we had in that study group, and also part of the debate before the House of Delegates when we were revising attempting to revise the DR, was how broad or how narrow it should be. And during those processes, it was decided that it should be broad, that if it's going to be good for the prosecutors, it ought to be good for the defense bar. And that's essentially the version that the Board of Bar Governors, the amendment to the DR that the Board of Bar Governors adopted and which was passed by the House of Delegates. That's the version that went to the Supreme Court. I attended both public sessions of the Supreme Court when they discussed this. And the first session was pretty much an informational discussion talking about the background of the problem. The second session was when at the first session, the court appointed a subcommittee of three to study it and make a recommendation to the full court. And they have minutes. At the second session, they reported. And essentially, the articulated reason of the court for not adopting the bar's amendment was that it was too broad and that it included too much and it, in essence, didn't address what the court, I believe, viewed as the critical problem, which was the effect it had on law enforcement. So to answer your question, that's been discussed, and the court's reaction was that they didn't want to go that far and that they wouldn't approve that. What we're trying to do here is to address the problems of the agencies that we represent that have been severely affected. That may be a broader debate and maybe a debate for a later time, but given the Supreme Court's action on the proposed amendment and where we are today, this needs to be done.
Representative Shetterly, I have a copy of the Supreme Court's, of the minutes of the Supreme Court's, and it's interesting to read in the last section where they go through the points that Mr. Sutherland just made in the last little section reporting from the subcommittee. It says, it may be that some kind of activity involving subterfuge is necessary to accomplish justice in the criminal law and civil rights arena, and for that reason, DR1-102 should be amended to permit some level of activity. Then they say, we do not express an opinion about the subject at this time.
Mm-hmm.
However, to approve the bar's proposed amendment would be to permit conduct by any member. So this is a response, I think, tailored to address what appear to be the concerns of the Supreme Court.
Mr. Chairman?
Yes, please, counsel.
Also, another reason that I came up with in dealing with the separation of powers issues is I think there is a an argument to be made that a government attorney has a different role. Quote, there's two cases that I came across that deal with the separation of powers issues between the legislature and the court. They are Sadler versus Oregon State Bar, which is at 275 Oregon 279, and Ramstead versus Morgan. The citation for that is 219 OR 383. Quoting the Sadler case, where the I think the standard has been in looking at whether a legislative act is whether it unduly burdens the role of the judiciary to discipline. Quoting the Sadler case, the overlap of judicial and legislative powers arises from the legislative police power to protect the public welfare by promoting the efficient and impartial administration of justice. So, Representative Shetterly, when I asked LC to draft this, I took that into consideration as well, that it's a different client, if you will, for a government officer, and I think that the courts might see that distinction.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Shetterly.
Well, I'll just say for the record, I am troubled by the double standard that this establishes. That I guess it presupposes that we need this for government enforcement actions and investigative actions, but not for any other investigative purposes. And I'm sure that history is replete with cases where attorneys have represented clients in actions against the government and have used subterfuge to establish their rights as against the government. And I'm troubled that we would vest government with a power and an authority here that we are not going to apply across the board. It seems to me we ought to look at what the conduct is and not presuppose that one side is on the needs it because they're doing good things and the other side doesn't need it because they're not doing as good of things or for whatever reason. It seems to me if we're focusing on the conduct, then the conduct should apply to private as well as public attorneys, and if it's a question of how it's being used, then I think the analysis ought to be the same, too, on both sides.
If I could respond, those are arguments, points that have been made in discussion. I would only point out that as a public official, that we have additional restraints on us imposed by the Constitution and other statutory provisions. When we engage in this type of activity, we are subject to all the restraints and limitations placed on us by the Fourth, Fifth, and Sixth Amendment, which are, you know, clearly enforceable in court. You cannot make the same argument for private conduct that doesn't have the same type of restraints. In addition, we in government have the additional restraint that we are accountable to the public either directly through an elected official such as the district attorney or the attorney general of the state or indirectly in my agency where the president appoints the attorney general, but you have tremendous oversight by congressional authorities. So there is, well, at first brush, it seems there may be unfairness there. I'd only point out that there's significant additional checks and balances and restraints on public lawyers.
Thank you, Mr. Sutherland. Any other questions? All right.
Just one thing.
Yes, Representative Vicky Walker.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just want to take this opportunity to thank Mr. Sutherland. I was upstairs listening before I came down. He is both a constituent and a practitioner in the courts in which I work, and it's a pleasure not having to take him down on my machine today because he talks very fast. It is good to see you here.
Another fast-talking government lawyer, right?
Absolutely.
Okay.
I guess that would be defamation, but it's in a legislative context, so it's privileged.
It's privileged.
Speech debate Texas today. Thank you very much, gentlemen. Next, I'll call up Mark McDonald from the Multnomah DA's office, Eric Wasserman from the Department of Justice, and former Representative Kevin Mannix.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman.
Good morning.
I'm Kevin Mannix from Salem. I'm an attorney in private practice, and I just got the nudge to go ahead first, so if that's all right, I will.
Please do.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, the Dash 3 amendments which are in front of you are the amendments which have ultimately been agreed upon by those concerned about the authority of government attorneys to ensure that the Constitution and statutes and court decisions of the state are followed, are capable of making sure that they are followed in terms of law enforcement activities throughout the state. The Dash 1 and Dash 2 amendments involved earlier iterations, and after discussion and consideration of the various arguments, it appears that the Dash 3 amendments, which are in front of you, which are a gut and stuff of the bill, are the most appropriate way to go technically. I think it's important at the beginning of this discussion to answer some of the important questions that Representative Schroederle raised about why this particular kind of legislation. And before we got into these amendments, we studied the case law in regard to separation of powers in Oregon, and we found that the Supreme Court has recognized an overlap of legislative authority as to attorney discipline and regulation in the area of the police power and the welfare of the state, has not yet recognized an overlap in authority as to general civil litigation. And we were very sensitive to the point that Representative Schroederle has made, which is there needs to be a universal fix about the authority of attorneys to participate in certain activities which may involve misrepresentation for the common good, but the Supreme Court would not recognize the authority of this legislature to impose such a universal solution. We are convinced that a universal solution is not within the power of the legislature. In fact, we held back on any solution, hoping that the Supreme Court would approve the bar's proposed rules changes because they would have been sufficient to promulgate a universal solution. We're stuck now with a situation where, pardon me, near the end of session, we anticipate a 6-month to 12-month delay in any further solution, looking at the one body that can impose, if I may use that term, a partial solution as to one major part of the problem. And do we pass up the opportunity to allow the common good to be furthered as to police activity or undercover activity involving public bodies or government agencies. And this bill addresses that part of the problem which can be addressed by the legislature. Many of us are very sensitive to the broader issues. As an attorney in private practice, I will tell you, I can go back over the last 27 years, and there are very many instances where I think the good of society was furthered by private investigators sometimes engaging in misrepresentation in order to ferret out fraud. And that is not resolved by this legislation. So we don't come here today pretending that a universal solution is in front of you, but in respect of the separation of powers, we tried to target the solution to that area which is within legislative authority. This says that government attorneys working with government agencies who do have a different obligation, as was mentioned earlier, will be empowered to assist those agencies in upholding the Constitution and the laws. That's what it says, and it does say that sometimes that involves covert activities where there may be misrepresentation or deceit. Please remember that the government attorneys are obligated to do justice, not simply get a result for their client. And I do recognize that in that sense, government attorneys do have a different charge. This legislation also recognizes that. But that's not to say that attorneys in private practice are not trying to achieve good, too. Again, I'm 100% private practitioner as we speak today, and I'm very sensitive to that part of this equation. Unfortunately, if we included that in this legislation, we would be inviting a rebuke from the Supreme Court. Instead, this has been crafted in a very careful fashion to go to the Supreme Court ultimately, as it will at some point, to say this is a good faith effort by the legislature to allow important law enforcement activities to proceed. If you can think back to the times when the FBI infiltrated the Ku Klux Klan in the South so that civil rights laws could be enforced, I need to tell you that they did so with advice and assistance from government attorneys. Well, if there was such an operation in Oregon today, those FBI agents would not proceed because they could not get advice and assistance from government attorneys, because the federal government now, quite properly, I think, says to the state, we will obey your disciplinary rules. This is the only jurisdiction in the United States where the kind of restrictions that have been imposed are in place. When I went back east 3 weeks ago to be interviewed by the Department of Justice, I was asked many questions, but I was asked only one Oregon-related question, which was, what are you going to do about the Gatti decision? The upper crust folks at the Department of Justice even knew the name of the case. They were very sensitive to the fact that law enforcement activities in the state have been frozen in place because of that decision. You are empowered today to address that part of the issue. And again, as Representative Shetterly's pointed out, there are broader issues that still must be addressed, and this might also be an invitation to the Supreme Court and the bar to continue working on those broader issues. But I do urge you to adopt the Dash 3 amendments and pass the bill out so that certain law enforcement activities can continue in the state. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Maddox. Representative Shetterly.
Thank you. Kevin, I think the testimony we heard before that this bill, this amendment, really doesn't solve the problem. It raises one gate, and the court is still going to have to raise the other gate through the amendment in the disciplinary rule. So I guess my question then, why not, since this statute isn't the fix itself, why not pass the statute that is the fix? And it seems to me the court could still say, well, in the next gate, we're going to let through these many cases, or we're going to let through government lawyers, but not through private lawyers. We're going to recognize this statutory change, or at least we're going to accommodate this statutory change for this purpose, but not for others. I don't see that a broad fix is necessarily at odds with the strategy of taking this back to the court to see what the court will give back. And if anything, it seems to me that the broad fix keeps the full conversation going, whereas this narrow fix, I think, stymies the conversation, and I'm not sure that there remains any more conversation about the broader universe of practitioners.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Shetterly, actually, this is not the total solution for government attorneys working with government agencies, and I need to state this very carefully. This puts government attorneys in the position of acting in good faith and assisting government agencies. But there still will be the question as to the interpretation of the disciplinary rules, which are unaffected by this legislation. However, that interpretation of the disciplinary rules by the Supreme Court encompassed a dual interpretation of an existing statute coupled with the rules. This bill pulls back the statutory part of that and redoes the recipe so as to reopen the question as to what does this disciplinary rule mean. If you take a look at the national movement in terms of the Code of Professional Responsibility and you separate out the statutory provision, you suddenly have in front of you a different recipe, and it's arguable that that this is a total solution for government attorneys. I want that to be clear, but practically speaking, it's not totally clear. It's not totally clear. And this is a tough area for us. If we try to put private attorneys into the solution, however, first of all, it doesn't fit the relating clause of this bill. Second of all, we have found that the discussion as to private attorneys does raise so many other issues, we don't think they can be quickly raised. The biggest problem, if I may, in answering that question is a matter of time. If we don't act during, if the legislature doesn't act during this session, we're left with a year and a half gap, perhaps 2 years in terms of any legislative action. There could still be this session another bill which refines that particular statute if members of this body want to do that, and I would certainly support that. This piece can clearly proceed and allow law enforcement to be conducted in Oregon. I don't think the Supreme Court is going to solve the problem for at least 6 months, more likely a year or a year and a half. In the meantime, all the law enforcement activities you've heard about stop.
Thank you. Speaking of time, we are running short on it this morning, so I'm going to ask Mr. McDonald and Mr. Wasserman for their comments as quickly as possible.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Mark McDonald, Senior Deputy District Attorney from Multnomah County. I really don't have much more to add other than to say that this bill is very important. At this at the local level, these undercover operations are going on. The problem is they're occurring without the consultation of the district attorney's office. I think it's good public policy to have prosecutors involved in the consultation of these types of operations. Believe it or not, I spend about a half my time or more of my time telling police officers about what they can't do. And it doesn't always make me popular, but I think prosecutors play a very important role in protecting individuals' rights when they're involved in these types of operations.
Thank you. Mr. Wasserman.
That's okay. Go ahead. Yes, Eric Wasserman from the Attorney General's office, and speaking on behalf of Attorney General Myers. The Attorney General supports any of the proposals, -1, 2, or 3, that this subcommittee would be willing to support. We really feel that this is a problem that needs a solution and needs one as quickly as possible. It has been the Attorney General's preference that the solution to the Gaddy decision be one that does not specifically authorize attorneys to personally engage in deceptive activity. That position is reflected in what you have as the -2 amendments. -2 actually contains the language that was developed within a working group of district attorneys and the Attorney General's office, and that working group proposed it, but the Attorney General and certainly the ODA are not wedded to that language, although the Attorney General would like you to know he would prefer personally not to authorize deception by lawyers. Regarding the -3, which seems to be the focus of discussion at this point, we would have some technical things to point out to you. In what would be, I guess, subsection 2.2, the provision of the section would apply to the Attorney General, Deputy Attorney General, District Attorneys, Deputy District Attorneys. We would strongly recommend that you eliminate the language regarding deputies. Attorney General and Deputy Attorney General refers to just two lawyers in this state, and would leave out all Assistant Attorney General. So we'd recommend you delete the language, the Deputy Attorney General. And then with regard to deputy district attorneys, it probably is sufficient to simply say district attorneys themselves. The deputies would carry the authority of the district attorneys who appointed them, and this would only make it other provisions and other statutes somewhat ambiguous. Regarding the separation of powers question that we had from Representative Shetterly, I would like to state one view about that. As Mr. Gaddy was disciplined under a statute enacted by this body, I think it's a very reasonable position for this body to take that it can write an exception to that statute that excludes certain forms of conduct or certain lawyers from that prohibition. And what we're really talking about here in the separation of powers clause is whether the legislature would be unduly burdening the judiciary, and I can't see how you would be unduly burdening them by narrowing a statute that you enacted that they personally had enforced. Thank you very much.
Mr. Chairman?
Yes, Representative Mannix.
One supplemental point in a few words. Lines 20 and 21 do incorporate any of the assistant attorneys general, because we did have generic language about and any other attorney employed by or working on behalf of a public body. There can be special assistant attorneys general. We certainly put that language in. I used to be an assistant attorney general. I didn't ever get to be attorney general, so I knew that there are some other people who needed to be covered, and any other attorney employed by or working on behalf of a public body covers all of the assistant attorneys general.
I should probably raise one additional point. Mr. Williamson of the State Bar spoke with me this morning about the language in subsection 2.1, which is, notwithstanding any other provision of ORS 9005 to 9755, I think the bar has a concern that this might could be interpreted to exclude the covered lawyers from any regulation by the Oregon State Bar, because that series of statutes contains the authorization to adopt the disciplinary rules themselves. So perhaps you should consider as a technical matter simply narrowing that series of statutes to the one statute that was the basis for Mr. Gaddy's discipline, and that was ORS 9527.
Mr. Chairman, if I may respond to that point, we consulted with David Hendricks, legislative counsel, in the drafting of this, and he made the very good point that what you needed was you take the universal chapter, and then you have a very specific exception for very specifically defined conduct, for fear that someone might find some other statutory provision somewhere in that chapter to further raise the issue of discipline. This says, this is what you may do, this little narrow range of conduct, despite all of these other provisions. It doesn't say you're not subject to the disciplinary code otherwise.
Okay. Thank you. Questions? Yes, Representative Ackerman.
Yes, I sort of hear two things. One, that all undercover operations are frozen in place and nothing's taking place. And secondly, it is taking place, but without the advice of legal counsel. I need to know the quantum of activity that's still going on now, despite the Gatti decision, covert operations. Are you down 50%, are you down 25%, or are you at the same level, but just with not, without legal advice?
I guess each of us should respond, Mr. Chairman. From the information I have, on the federal level, any covert activities that involve attorney assistance, which I understand to be most of them, if not all of them, are shut down. And I guess others need to speak to the others.
Members of the committee, Mark McDonald, Representative Ackerman, local police agencies, city police departments, county sheriff's office continue to conduct undercover activities, but they're not doing it with consultation with DAs.
And, Mr. Chair, Representative Ackerman, within the Department of Justice, we have specifically halted all undercover activities by criminal investigators and financial fraud investigators employed by our division.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay, thank you, gentlemen. Now I'd like to call up Ed Harnden, President of the Oregon State Bar, Charlie Williamson, Oregon State Bar, and Bill Hauser.
Thank you, Mr. Chair Williams. Ed Harnden, President of the Oregon State Bar. As I believe the committee is aware, and I realize your time is short, I appointed a committee some time ago that studied the issue. Had a proposal to the Board of Governors, which was approved, sent along to the House of Delegates of the Oregon State Bar, where it was approved. It was not accepted by the Supreme Court. I have subsequently appointed a committee which includes, is chaired by Charlie Williamson, includes members, a member from the Attorney General's office, and several other individuals, one of whom is an expert on ethics issues. We share several of Representative Shetterly's concerns, particularly about the non-prosecutorial area not being included in this. That was the goal of the original proposal that came out of the House of Delegates, was to cover the umbrella issues and make sure that we had included everyone. And the concerns are pretty widespread. It doesn't matter whether you're the prosecutor or the defense. Do these issues allow you to commit perjury? Do they allow you to lie to a judge or misrepresent things to a judge, to the defense counsel? What would happen if Gatti were a prosecutor? Those type of issues. As to this bill itself, I believe that if it is a partial fix to just take care of the statute that was involved in Gatti, then that's exactly what should happen. And if it's narrower than Gatti, which would be just for prosecutors, we should just take care of that fix. What that would mean is not including the broad range of all of ORS 9.005 through 9.755, which is a huge category, but I would recommend to you that you address just the statute that was addressed by the Supreme Court in Gatti, that being ORS 9.527, subsection 4, which is the misrepresentation subsection, and if it's limited to that, it eliminates, I believe, a whole range of potential problems that, given the short time that you've had to look at this and that we've had to look at it, we have not been able to develop all the scenarios or understand fully where that might lead prosecutors or others. I would ask if I could to have Charlie Williamson, who's chair of the committee, address that further.
Thank you, Ed, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Charles Williamson. I'm an attorney from Portland. It's a really difficult area, and I think we have sympathized with law enforcement and would like to see the problem remedied for them. The Supreme Court has appointed a subcommittee of justices, Gillette, Durham, and Dominguez, and the committee that Ed appointed met with them for about 2 hours on Monday trying to see what they would agree to in amending the rules, and we're going back to them with some suggestions. I think that the problem that has been pointed out on this all-inclusive suggestion that apparently arose in legislative council, essentially you're exempting law enforcement in a covert activity from requirements to carry out court orders to support the Constitution. It's a really, I think, overly broad way it's been drafted. The other thing that we had in our proposed rule that went to the Supreme Court was that the covert activity had to be a lawful covert activity. And that I think if you inserted the word lawful before covert activities each time it appears in the bill, that would be helpful too. We would like to see the Supreme Court, I think, has sympathize most with both law enforcement and civil rights enforcement, especially Fair Housing Council and legal aid that try to enforce anti-discrimination laws, and both in housing and employment. And so I think the court is, this is my guess, inclined to look more favorably upon a rule that solves those problems too, in addition to the covert activities. And some of the judges, I think there may be seven different views on the Supreme Court right now, seem to think that it should apply to all lawyers.
Doesn't come out that way in their opinions, though, Charlie.
This is really a very frustrating thing we've been through. You do have a situation where you have a personal injury attorney who has an automobile plaintiff come into his office right after the accident, and the defendant's still in a hospital, and can the plaintiff hire an investigator to go talk to the defendant as a covert activity and say that he's from the defendant's insurance company and get a statement from them that way? And that's the kind of, it may be that when you have the profit motive for private attorneys in effect, it may be that you need to have some more of a leash, and you don't want to necessarily sanction that sort of activity.
Let me, if I can, just to make clear, on the Dash 3 amendments, do you have specific, have you had a chance to write your comments? Because it sounds like not only do you have a problem with the broader aspects of the Section 1 reference, or the Section 2 reference, but there was also some lawful language that you felt like you needed to insert.
Mr. Chair Williams, I believe if you delete at the on line 6 and 7, 9.005 to 9.755, and insert 9.527, subsection 4,
and if you flip on lines 10 before covert activity, put in lawful, and the same thing on lines 13 and 15, that would be helpful.
And I believe that's the activity that the prosecutors and law enforcement agencies are talking about. They're dealing with advising police agencies, for instance, on how to conduct lawful activity, which might entail misrepresentation. So I don't believe there's any concern with making it lawful covert activity.
Okay. Questions for either of the members from the bar? Okay, then.
Thank you very much.
Okay,
Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Mr. Hauser.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Bill Hauser. I'm with the Oregon Criminal Defense Lawyers Association. The Oregon Criminal Defense Lawyers Association, through its board of directors, came out formally against the change of the disciplinary rules that was proposed and that the Supreme Court rejected. And because of that, we also are opposed to the fix that is before the committee in any of the Dash amendments. A lot of the comments that I have concerning the concerns have already been discussed in great detail by Representative Shetterly and other members that are on the panel, so I won't go into a lot of that. However, I have one other area that I would like to talk about, simply because I have some questions, and I'm not sure exactly why they've included this, but there might be a good reason. I just don't know what it is. On lines 13 through 17 of the Dash 3s and the Section B, I think, of all of the Dashes, they allow for the participate in the covert activities rather than just give legal advice or direction. And I wonder why they need to participate. What is special about that when most of the time lawyers give advice and direction? So that's just a concern that I have concerning the Dash 3, actually all the Dashes, and there may be a good reason for it. I just don't know what it is. Thank you.
Representative Dinkfelder.
Actually, I was going to ask you that question about how you felt about lines 13 through 18, but if 13 through 17, if if those were removed, do you still have the same problems with this amendment?
Yes, Chairman Williams, Representative Dinkfelder, we endorse the principle that lawyers should not engage in conduct involving dishonesty, fraud, deceit, or misrepresentation, so we would have the same problems.
Any other questions? Thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. Markey, can I bring you back up? And I'm looking for our U.S. attorney. Is he still in the room?
That's in the bar.
That's all right. Representative Mannix talks in class all the time. We're used to it.
This is the president of the bar, I think.
Oh, was the president of the bar?
Yes.
Oh, well, we'll get in trouble for that. All right. I want your comments on the bar's recommended changes, the limitation to just the provision that was referenced in Gatti, as well as the insertion of the word lawful in front of the word covert in each.
If I may address the issue about lawful, the problem there is if a covert activity in which you purchase drugs is not lawful, there are not specific exceptions that permit police officers to engage in certain activities. The exception is that they're not doing it with an unlawful intent. A covert activity is, by its nature, and I know the gentleman from the Criminal Defense Lawyers Association said that we don't believe that lawyers ought to engage in dishonesty or deceit. I think that's a little disingenuous when the fact of the matter is that the job of attorneys is to advocate on behalf of their clients, and sometimes that's positing a factual situation, which in some cases, I've been a defense attorney, we may not know to be true, but we know it's to the advantage of our. I don't think anybody intends to allow lawyers themselves to engage in the kind of conduct that Mr. Gatti did. I would agree with the Supreme Court to the first part of what they did. What Mr. Gatti did, he should not have done. If a deputy district attorney in my office did that, I would sanction them. But the Supreme Court went way beyond that, and that's our concern. And our concern is if some version of this doesn't go through now, and I understand Representative Shetterly's concerns, and I think the president of the bar rightfully said that groups like civil rights groups and fair housing, consumer advocates, I started my career as a consumer fraud investigator in the DA's office. But as I think Mr. Sutherland accurately pointed out, government lawyers are subject to a lot of other restrictions that private lawyers are not. For people like me, I'm subject to election, and I'm subject to a number of other rules that frankly private lawyers are not. And I don't, although when the brief was filed, by the amicus briefs were filed, they were joined by fair housing groups and civil rights groups. The group that is here before you on bended knee literally today are law enforcement groups.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Shetterly.
Well, I just want to take a little issue with that. I mean, not so much issue. I understand that government lawyers are restricted in ways that private attorneys aren't. But prosecuting attorneys have, work in concert with police agencies and other arms of government that attorneys in private practice don't have. I mean, you're talking about right now how covert investigations are actually taking place now without the specific direction or participation of attorneys. I'll bet that's not happening on the other side of the fence because attorneys in private practice just don't have those mechanisms, don't have those forces arrayed that can do the work for them and then bring the results of their investigations and efforts. And I'm still troubled. I'd like to do this, but I'm troubled that we're creating a disequilibrium here between government on one side and private citizens and the attorneys that represent them on the other side.
Can you, Mr. Markey, you didn't respond to the more narrow limitation in Section 2 at the top that was simply limited to the one provision of ORS Chapter 9. Are you less troubled by that?
I am less troubled by that. I admit to that I'm not that familiar with the construction. What the president of the bar said sounded reasonable, and certainly if there's a concern that this would exempt prosecutors from all regulation of the bar, that would be a legitimate concern about the draft.
Mr. Sutherland?
In answer to that question, the intent is to modify the statute that the Supreme Court dealt with in Gatti, which was ORS 9.5724. It's not the intention, our intention is not to modify any other legal or ethical requirements that are imposed upon lawyers. As an example, this is not intended to change DR 7-104, which deals with contact with represented persons. This deals only with our advising, directing, or concurrence in undercover activities. So if that is the if that's the intent of the change, then we agree that it should be narrowed and limited just to that one statute. Do you want to address the lawful issue?
If you'd like, briefly.
No one is suggesting by this that lawyers that are government lawyers should lie to courts or to other attorneys or to clients. We as lawyers carry a special obligation in society to speak truthfully, and we carry with that some baggage and a higher obligation. This statute is merely directed towards our giving advice to law enforcement officers who are otherwise engaged in lawful activity. They are constrained by statutes, by constitutional provisions. I don't have any problem with the word lawful being included, except to the extent that if some point along the line the court says, no, you know, in good faith, you overstep the lawful, and then you're going to be subject to disciplinary proceedings. It seems to me that it really puts a person in a bind. But certainly it's not the intent to say that we can authorize burglaries or that we can authorize searches that are in violation of the Fourth Amendment. And if lawful adds to that concept, which I think is already engrafted upon it, so be it. We are not saying that we should engage in illegal searches and seizures, inappropriate contacts with represented parties, burglaries, or any other type of activities. Recognizing, though, as Ms. Marquis said, that when you are infiltrating a criminal enterprise, organized crime, there are times when you are brought along, and if you weren't a government agent, you would be a co-conspirator. If you are buying drugs, or if you're doing a reverse sting and you are providing chemicals, that may be illegal. It shouldn't be prohibited by the section, and a lawyer should not be disciplined because they're engaging in that type of advice.
Mr. Chairman, if you detect a note of urgency, there is one, because although the issues raised by Representative Shetterly are entirely reasonable and were attempted to be addressed by the resolution that I spoke of at the House of Delegates, right now there are lots of people who are selling drugs, manufacturing child pornography, ripping people off, defrauding the state, or getting away with it. And I think Representative Ackerman asked a legitimate question about exactly where that falls. And what's happening is, in the federal agencies, nothing is happening. And under the aegis of the state attorney generals, they're shut down. We really don't know the answer in terms of local agencies, because we have one of these situations that we're going on. Don't tell us about it, because we can't tell you.
Well, I'm having a premonition that former Representative Mannix has something else to add. So if you'd step forward to the table and limit his comments to about 45 seconds, if you can.
Lawful should not go in because you create a catch-22 situation. But we already added limiting language to this bill. It says, covert activities that are conducted by the federal government for the purpose, they're also talking about state, for the purpose of enforcing laws is the limiting phrase. The activity has to be for the purpose of enforcing laws. That was the limiting phrase, that sometimes the activity may be apparently unlawful at the time, but it's for the purpose of enforcing laws. I thought it was important to get that on the record.
Representative Mannix, I know when I tell you 45 seconds, you're one of the few people who can stick to it. I appreciate it very, very much. Okay, thank you, gentlemen. Committee, we're going to close the public hearing on House Bill 3857. We're going to open a work session. Let me tell you what my recommendation is. I'm going to recommend that we move the bill to the full committee without adoption of the amendments. I'm going to ask Mr. Prince to have the amendments redrafted so they'll be in front of the committee for tomorrow's consideration, and to give the committee an opportunity to consider what they've heard here today, and for me to figure out whether or not I'm going to have the votes in the full committee to be able to move this out. So the chair would move House Bill 3857 without amendments to the full committee without recommendation. Is there any discussion? Is there any objection? We'll take this issue up tomorrow morning. If I can find my agenda, we are now going to open a public hearing on House Bill, or excuse me, on Senate Bill 230A. And I would ask Connie Haas, Kathy Osborne. Nope, let me back up. Kathy, I'm going to do the fours before I do the againsts. So I'm going to ask Connie Haas, Stephan Otto, Sharon Harmon to come forward.
Yeah, okay, I'll be down.
And I'm going to, is it here?
Oh, my God, this is so complicated.
Which one?
The call.
230?
Yeah.
230? Center of maneuver to the Senate.
Okay, Connie, Mr. Otto, and Ms. Harmon, why don't, since you're there and ready to go, Sharon, why don't you start? And I'm going to ask you to keep it short if you can.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, 2 points of note. I'm not an attorney, and my comments will be brief. We're here today to talk about Senate Bill 230, and I think it's important to couch this bill in the realm of what its intent is, and that we're talking about a crime of violence. It really doesn't matter whether we're talking about an animal or a person, and please forgive me, I'm not equating these two with having the same rights. We are talking about acts of violence and how we as a society will address those acts of violence. Senate Bill 230 has been worked on by a number of varying interest groups. We're here today as a largely unified front to talk about the points that are important to all of us. What Senate Bill 230 does is it clarifies some tricky definitions that have held up some important prosecutions with clarifying language. What Senate Bill 230 also does is help link other acts of violence so that we recognize we're all talking about the same thing here. It's no longer something that children do. It's no longer something that's excusable. We're talking about violent acts, whether they be against an animal or a person, and moving those penalties to meet the crime. We know that people that abuse animals often go on to abuse people. We know that people, and I mean largely men, that abuse women and children often abuse animals, and it's time to really relate those statutorily, and Senate Bill 230 provides that provision, particularly with Section 8. There's other testimony to be presented here. I don't want to take anything away from Mr. Otto's or Ms. Haas' presentation. I'm just here as an advocate for the welfare of animals in our community. I'm here also to tell you that we're just talking about violent acts in our society, and that's what Senate Bill 230 does. If you have any questions, I'd be happy to answer them. Thank you.
I appreciate it, Sharon. I'm going to ask, actually, Connie and Stephan, if you'd both step back as well, Ms. Harmon, to give courtesy to Senator Deckard and Senator Courtney to come forward. And they both want to testify on this bill, and I'm confident that they have other issues that they need to address in the Senate. At least we hope they do.
House bill?
House bills, yeah.
Senator, you don't know how much pleasure it gives me to have you here testifying in front of us. Senator Courtney, welcome. Senator Deckard as well. Please begin. Senator Deckard, if you don't mind, I'm going to defer to the senior senator at the table.
Mr. Chair, it is important that the senator, who is the chief sponsor of this bill, be allowed to speak first, please.
Okay.
Not again.
Yeah, here we go. Senator Deckard, please begin.
You know, Chair Williams, I would just hate to,
go. Okay. Going once. Let's get going, guys.
Mr. Chair, members of the Judiciary Committee, it's good to be with you. I will be brief on this. Senate Bill 230 comes from the Senate with a great deal of work. I introduced this bill probably 2 or 3 months ago. It's a animal abuse update, updating our statutes on animal abuse. I came upon this bill after talking to a few folks from our neck of the woods, who one of them was a mom who lives on Bull Mountain, who her and her two children were at the zoo camp and witnessed some real severe and traumatic abuse of the elephant there. The case, the Rose 2 case, received a great deal of publicity. The elephant had 182, I believe, lacerations. And what we found from that situation was, and that's what the prosecutors were very, very clear on, is that we needed to update our statutes to ensure that we can prosecute these cases. So we got a work group together of just about all the players on this from when we introduced the bill. We had members, a representative from the Cattlemen's Association, and I think it's important to note, I did it on the Senate floor, and they've asked me to do it again in the committee, is that the cattlemen had concerns that in some ways this might affect them, and so we amended the bill to ensure that in no way does this affect good animal husbandry practices and the fine statutes that we have in that area. And that has got the cattlemen to be okay with the bill, and I believe they are neutral on the bill. We had Jim Welsh from the Oregon Family Farm Association as part of our work group, along with prosecutors, a couple prosecutors. One senator who really just was unbelievably effective and helpful, and I just marveled at his, and he's seated to my right here, at his ability to craft legislation. And then Senator Steve Harper was also on the work group, and that's who produced the A. Engross version of Senate Bill 230, which I think is a fine compromise, really gets at the definition of physical trauma to an animal, focuses in on domestic animals, which the intent of the bill was to do, and updates our statutes.
Thank you, Senator Deckard. Senator Courtney.
Mr. Chair, members of the Civil Subcommittee of the House Judiciary Committee, I think you should know that I didn't do that much, but I you should feel comfortable knowing that the groups that really came in on this bill, and there were some real concerns early on. In fact, I wasn't convinced the bill would ever get out of the Senate Judiciary Committee. I really wasn't. And Senator Deckard and his work group kept at it and at it and at it. And not only did it get out, it came off the Senate floor. And when you get that kind of coming together, it's my experience as a veteran legislator, you have a remarkable piece of legislation because you have something that everybody can take pride in, everybody can feel comfortable with. And so I think you can take comfort in the bill that is before you has been thoroughly worked and evaluated. And then all the players, some of which were extremely reluctant early on, one group has already been noted by Senator Deckard, has come on board. So that's all I can add. I compliment him and his staff who worked very, very hard on this, as well as all the players. I think it is a bill in which nobody got run over. Everybody got listened to. I call it the Rosie 2 bill, and he's not going to show you the visual aid, which he did show us on the opening day weeks ago in the side of the elephant. And whether you feel strongly about elephants or pets or not, if you could have seen the incredible gashes and cuts to the hide of an elephant. An elephant, I think, has a pretty tough hide. Obviously, somebody had savaged that animal pretty badly, and I know that no one agrees to that. Then I think you would have felt that that's something that none of us want and will tolerate in our society. This bill addresses that situation and others, but it does it in a way that takes into consideration the cattlemen, the farming interest, and those individuals that deal with animal on an everyday basis. And I want Representative Wilson to note that in particular, because I've been spending a lot of time recently with Representative Wilson, and he and I have come together in sort of an emotional bonding way. So I wanted him to know that.
Thank you, gentlemen. I hesitate to add, oh, Representative Shetland.
Oh, now I know.
Do you have questions?
Well, I do.
Please.
Okay, Representative Lowe is drawing a picture of Rosie, too, here. and I guess my question is, why are we equating the abuse that Rosie, too, suffered with failure of an owner to provide adequate bedding? I mean, they're both equivalent offenses under the under this statute. Why?
Mr. Chair, Representative Shetterly, I think, and we'll have a couple prosecutors testify after myself, but I think what they'll testify to, and this is what they brought to the work group, was that the statutes that we have were very unclear, and from a case of, and we've heard a lot about the case of Rose too, but this really deals with, I think that's only tagged because that's one that everyone knows about. And what we found from speaking with several of the prosecutors is that they're not able to prosecute many, many everyday cases of animal neglect and abuse. And I believe it's page 4 of the bill, where it's recklessly killing an animal under circumstances manifesting extreme indifference to the life of an animal, a pretty high bar that is set to ensure that these really are, and that's what really struck me is the more I got into this, is the number of examples, because I just didn't know how often this occurs in my neighborhood and other neighborhoods across Oregon. And we have other language in here dealing with juveniles, because the nature of how many juveniles are engaged in this and requiring a psychiatric evaluation of juveniles, because when I carried this bill on the Senate floor, we referred to the real, that once a juvenile starts severely abusing an animal, the statistics of the chances that that person will then abuse women in marriage, I think it's 60-70% of domestic violence abusers first abused an animal. They did case studies of serial killers, and I think it was a large majority of our serial killers had first abused animals, and so that's what the prosecutors were able to bring to the work group.
Mr. Chair, Representative Shetley, you should know that I mentioned Rosie, too, because that's what brought it here.
Sure.
Once you get into these situations, and this happened in my bestiality bill, and the DAs come forward and the judges, and they start to describe their everyday world that this is obvious treatment we can't handle, we don't want to accept, but they do not have in law the ability to prosecute. And so this has really become much more, this is a comprehensive, if I may say so, animal abuse bill in front of you. I did mention Rosie too, but your question points to that, and they're here, and they will get into exactly why they felt this language was necessary. So it goes beyond that. I just wanted to highlight the fact that that's what riveted, stayed in the minds of the Senate Judiciary Committee when they started out on this thing, is that we can't allow this kind of conduct. And then the DAs came forward, the work group came forward, and it got us into that kind of discussion, if I may be very frank with you. That section itself, Mr. Chair, Representative Shelley, does not deal specifically with what happened to Rosie, too. I'll be very frank with you. But it does deal with some other things going on out there that when the DAs, people come pounding to the scream into the DA and say, I want you to prosecute, they can't do it. So, and I really think the answer to your question should come from prosecutors versus myself. And even though we work with the bill, I don't have that kind of expertise.
Thank you. Are there any other questions? That's right. Representative Krieger.
Just very briefly, Mr. Chair. Mm-hmm. There's not a definition in statute regarding good animal husbandry that I've ever seen. It's kind of a, I don't know what you really call it. I would assume that you never intended to interfere with what would be historically been considered good animal husbandry. Is that right?
Mr. Chair, Representative Quinger, that is correct. And that was, you'll find on page 2, section 7, though not amended, language on good animal husbandry, but I think that was the important thing that, and I was appreciative of this, that the cattlemen brought to our work group, is to ensure that in no way, and so they had 5 concerns. If you don't have a letter from them, we can get you a copy. It might be in your file. That they had 5 concerns that in some way this might affect good animal husbandry, and so I'm here to tell you as one of the participants and sponsors of this legislation that in no way should we affect the good animal husbandry statutes, and I think you'll find at least language on page 2 of this bill.
Chair Williams, Representative Krieger, I think the issue that held the bill up as long as it did was this issue you're talking about. How do we make sure that we don't interfere with good animal husbandry? How can they reach a comfort zone, those individuals, to deal with that on an everyday basis? And I'm very sincere about that. And the breakthrough has finally come, we feel, in this legislation. And they're here, or as the good senator said, I believe they've even have a written document to that effect. So I'm not an expert in that area, but that kept coming back and coming back and coming back.
Representative Lowe.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I just wanted to make a comment that I engage in doodling and drawing in order to fully link up my left brain and right brain. It's been scientifically proven that you can enter into creative thinking better that way if you doodle while you're thinking of creative solutions. And as I was completing my task, thinking about this bill, I think that it is a creative solution to the problem, and I'm glad that you brought it forward. Just
thank
wanted
you,
to know I wasn't wasting my time.
I'd ask the rest of the committee members to start doodling.
Yes.
Mr. Chair.
I'll give lessons.
I'd like to know, since she doodles, that's sort of a very sentimental and nice thing. If you were to do a doodle of me, and I'm not going to take I'm not going to take the committee's time.
I appreciate that.
But I'd like to know what kind of doodle I'd be. I mean, I'd like to know that. Those things mean a lot to me.
Well, and I'll ask Representative Lowe to doodle you at some future time.
All right. It's too late. You did say doodle, didn't you?
I said doodle.
We're going to ask
Mr. Otto and Ms. Harmon to come up and excuse the two good senators to return to their dutiful business in the Senate.
Here, I'll just give you this. You can take it and enjoy.
Mr. Otto and Ms. Haas, Ms. Harmon, I think you were finished, if that's all right. If you'd come up, please. We do have floor session in 5 minutes. I have asked that we be excused at least until we are under a call of the House or until they call us for individual members who have to carry bills. So we'll attempt to continue to work so long as we have a quorum. Please proceed.
Chair Williams and members of the committee, my name is Connie Haas. I reside in Washington County, and I'm the person who asked Senator Deckert to sponsor this bill, and I did it because I, as most members of the public, couldn't understand why the abuser of Rose 2 was not prosecuted by the Multnomah County District Attorney. The large blue folders you were given are to honor the request that we had not have a parade of people, 30 people could have come today to testify. So what we did instead, because of the very speedy, wondrously speedy scheduling of this hearing since this bill passed on the Senate floor, there wasn't time for people to address letters to this committee specifically, so we've copied the Senate Judiciary Hearing testimony, put it into a folder for you, along with supplemental materials that may help answer some questions. I'd point out to you, especially at the back of that blue notebook, are some grids that compare current law to what the law would be if this bill is passed. I basically want to cover two issues in my own testimony to you today very briefly, and that is that after the Multnomah County District Attorney said they couldn't prosecute this bill, this offense, I wanted to know why. And I found out in short order that Oregon humane laws had been tied to human assault statute definitions years ago, so that the definitions that created a crime of assault for a human were also used to create the crime of abuse of an animal. The problem became when Oregon appellate courts decided through many decisions that in order to establish whether assault and pain and suffering had happened, there would have to be testimony pertaining to how long had how much pain been suffered. And since this question cannot be answered by any animal and no expert can even provide that factual testimony, they can speculate, but they can't put it in terms good enough for a court of law, it became virtually impossible to prosecute animal abuse in Oregon unless the abuser killed or permanently crippled his or her victim. And this was the basis of the Rose 2 situation, a very public situation, but this occasion occurs in every county for small animals and for smaller abuse cases. I wanted you to understand how grotesquely obvious the wounds to the animal were. There were 176 like this. And still, those injuries were not considered abuse under the current statute. And so this bill, as Senator Deckert and Senator Courtney have explained to you, was put together by a very large coalition of people formed first by me last summer, and then as I brought it to Senator Deckert and he took over the legislative attack to try to put this together in a way that would satisfy the concerns of many people, a very large coalition of people coming together and putting this bill into a form that we could all compromise and agree on. The bill will fix the gaping hole in the statute by making the definition of physical trauma to an animal and physical injury relevant to animals by the obvious existence of the injuries, such as the ones in the pictures and the ones in the pictures in your folder. I would also like to point out that ORS chapter, which this bill will amend, which is chapter 167 containing the humane laws, has at 167.335, and that's there's a copy of that in your notebook as well, a clear exemption for 9 categories of animal use and care, including veterinary care, animal husbandry, transportation of poultry, and rodeos, and like I said, 9 other categories. and we were very clear that we would not attempt in any way to change that exemption. Nowhere in ORS or in Oregon, the regulations, the OAR, is there a definition of animal husbandry or veterinary care per se, and that's good because that leaves those professions and those businesses the opportunity to define amongst themselves in their professional organizations and capacities what will constitute good animal husbandry, what will constitute good veterinary care, and so forth. And we respect the legislative intent of the creation of 167.335, and it applies to all of the points in Senate Bill 230A and gross that would be put into Chapter 167. I'd also like to state my own view that there is very little in the way of increased penalties in this bill. The two cases where penalties would increase would be consistent with similar crimes and the punishments in Oregon law, as would the penalty for the proposed new offense category of aggravated animal neglect. I would like to point out that there is a statute in Oregon law in Chapter 161 that makes it a Class A misdemeanor to cut a shrub in a cemetery. Now, that's a much higher level of punishment than we are asking for the raise to a Class B misdemeanor of second-degree animal abuse. Other relevant Oregon law covers situations of people needing to protect themselves from dangerous animals. There was a concern during the production of this bill about people needing to, if they would kill or injure an animal that was attacking them, if they had to get rid of an animal that was causing disease under their house. There's other Oregon law that covers each of those cases, and therefore you wouldn't be prosecuted for killing a raccoon under your house or shooting a dog that was coming at you if it was going to kill you or tear you apart. So I just wanted, because those issues had come up so strongly, I wanted to point out that there's other Oregon law that speaks to those exemptions, and Stefan actually can give you much more specific on that. I asked the subcommittee to vote to send this bill to the full House with a recommendation that they pass it out of committee and to the House floor. We really need this bill, and thank you for your time. If you have any questions, I'd be glad to answer what I can.
Thank you, Ms. Haas. Why don't we allow Mr. Otto to testify briefly, and then we'll take questions.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I'm Stefan Otto. I'm counsel for the Animal Legal Defense Fund here in support of Senate Bill 230. I'm not going to speak too much. Most of my testimony is with you right now. Including that is a table showing comparisons, the section-by-section breakdown of what this bill does, and some frequently asked questions about this bill. Also, there is a photo in there, too, that shows kind of why we're here, talking about some of the onerous neglect that we see in cases all across the state. It's been 6 years since we've had any substantive changes to the animal cruelty laws in the state. As other people have spoken already, this bill mainly fixes some of the problems in the definitions so that law enforcement can adequately enforce these existing laws. It also addresses the knowledge that we have even more so now that there is a strong link between animal abuse and crimes against other members of our communities. So with that, I just want to let you know that this is a reasonable approach. It's measured. We have supporters from all across the state, including law enforcement communities, vets, police, prosecutors, and the like. So with that, I'd like to see if you have any questions that I can answer.
Are there questions for either of these two, Representative Shetterly?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I understand the discussion about animal husbandry. There's one other statute aspect, part of this, though, that gives me a little bit of pause in how it relates to, let's say, cattlemen or people who raise animals. If you look on page 2, this is in the section that defines minimum care, and it relates to animals, not just domestic animals, but this section relates to animals, and that is one of the requirements, open or adequate access to potable water in sufficient quantity to satisfy the animal's needs. We're facing the prospect of a drought in parts of the state. If we've got ranchers that have animals out over the 20,000 acres, what's the requirement? It's one thing for them to lose their animals, of course, to drought. Are we making them felons as well if they don't get out and purchase water? I'm just wondering what the impact there is on not on husbandry so much, but on the raising of animals and the obligation that a rancher would have under that section.
Mr. Chair, Representative Shetterly, the section that you referred to is already part of the statutes currently in the state. That's housekeeping where you see them in bold. They've been moved to a different section. The question is whether somebody should have responsibility for animals that they own, and having animals is a choice. If somebody does make that choice to have animals, then what our state has said is there are some minimum standards that you must follow to take care of those animals, and that would be including providing them water.
If I might add a comment, Chair Williams and Representative Shetterly, I believe in the situation of a drought, that because that's an emergency situation, there are provisions to allow for the fact that there will be losses, and there will be animal life losses. There will be animal life loss in the wetlands that dry up. There will be fish losses. And I really can't feature any district attorney prosecuting a farmer whose animal had died from that.
Any other questions for these two witnesses? Thank you very much. I'll now call Kathy Osborne, Bill Hauser. Is Nancy Miller in the room? Nancy, did you want to say something about this? Okay, do you want to come up real quick?
Thank you, Ms. Chase.
You know what, I'm going to ask Nancy to start, if that's okay, and then we'll go to you two.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Very briefly, Nancy Miller, Director of the Juvenile Court Programs Division of the State Court Administrator's Office. We just had a concern in Section 4 with the mandatory